This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello and welcome to The Stand with Eamon Dunphy. Now, the big news on the COVID front is the emergence in South Africa of a new variant of this virus. It's called Omicron, and it was discovered in a laboratory in South Africa. South Africans were very quick to alert the world, and they have done the responsible thing. However, it has caused concern everywhere. We don't know too much about this variant at the moment. It may be much more transmissible, some people believe. But we're joined now by Tomás Ryan, Associate Professor at the School of Biochemistry and Immunology at Trinity College. Tomás has covered COVID with us on The Stand, and he is a consistent voice, and he has been consistently right. And one of the problems, I personally believe, with public discourse on this crisis is the multiplicity of voices, many of them not knowing what they're talking about and representing special interests. So Tomás has proved extremely good, and we are very happy to have him and grateful to have him. Tomás, thank you very much for joining us. This new variant, Omicron, discovered in South Africa, they were quick to alert the world. Many people feel, I want to talk to you about the variant, obviously, but many people feel that they have been punished for being upfront and quick with the information by having travel restrictions imposed on them, quite heavy restrictions on South Africa and seven other Southern African countries. What's your view on that?
Well, first of all, I think that this variant, the Omicron variant, is... we need extreme caution for this. It's not a time to panic, but I think we need a very significant degree of caution while we get through this current period of uncertainty. With respect to your question about how South Africa have been treated, South African public health officials, South African scientists and laboratory professionals have done an outstanding job in quickly identifying this variant and communicating it to the world. It didn't originate in South Africa. We're not sure where it originated. Probably it originated in Botswana, but we don't know. It's not very important where it originated. So we call them, obviously, by this World Health Organization designated lettering system, and that's why it's called Omicron. With respect to how we respond to this from a travel perspective, it's interesting to see how quickly the conversation internationally has gone to how we regulate travel. On one hand, for restricting movement of this variant, which I think is extremely important. But on the other hand, the conflicting issue of therefore punishing countries, so yes. For example, South Africa, who've contributed so much to warning the world. It's not really an area that I'm used to thinking about. So when dealing with these issues, I tend to defer to colleagues of mine, such as Professor Jerry Killeen, who spends half his life working in the field in sub-Saharan Africa and who understands both infectious diseases and the international politics behind it very well. And there's no reason why you can't do both. There's no reason why you can't restrict travel temporarily into your own country for the public health security of your population, whilst at the same time not restrict travel to countries such as South Africa for the purposes of helping with our public effort. And of course, even in zero COVID countries, there hasn't been disruption of freight or supply chains or essential or travel of essential personnel. Having said all that, if we're going to have travel restrictions, and incidentally, you probably won't be surprised to hear that I would very much support a few weeks of very robust travel restrictions just while we find out more about this variant. But they have to be for essentially all travel origins, because we know that the variants are on tour. And we know this variant has already popped up in many European countries, Germany, England, Scotland, Spain, Canada, Switzerland, Sweden, Netherlands, and Belgium. And so it may already be here also. So targeting travel restrictions to places such as South Africa are really sort of meaningless. If you're going to do them for protecting your own country, then by all means do them, and I think we should, but they need to be more sensible.
Right. Now, a consensus has emerged over the past 48 hours that it will take a couple of weeks, 2 to 3 weeks, to find answers to the questions we need to ask about. One question is, how transmissible is this variant, Omicron? Two, how sick will people be when they contract it? C, how effective will the vaccines we have at the moment be in repelling it? They're the three main questions, but there are, of course, other questions. One of them is about reinfection. So if we start at the top, it's hard to form a judgment, isn't it, about how concerned we ought to be until we know the answers to those questions.
I think you've hit the nail on the head, Eamon. Those are the three questions that we need to understand about Omicron. We are not completely in the dark. And that's part of the reason why there's been such concern so quickly. It's not just because the South African scientific community were so quick and thorough to report this. It's also because the genetic structure of this virus is in itself very worrying. Now, the SARS-CoV-2 virus mutates all the time. All living organisms mutate all the time. That's how life evolves. And there are far more variants of SARS-CoV-2 than you've ever heard about. Yes. And the reason for that is most of them are innocuous. Most of them just come in different colors, but they don't have any clinical relevance. And occasionally, a mutation comes along that results in a virus variant that is advantageous for the virus. It either makes it better at transmitting, or it may help evade the immune response. And then those are selected for by Charles Darwin, natural selection, which results in them becoming prevalent in the population. Those are the ones that we're concerned about, like the Alpha variant that we imported into Ireland as a consequence of the Christmas reopening. And then like the Delta variant, which originated, as far as we can tell, in India. What's notable is that when you consider how quickly we learned about those two variants, it took a while for us to accept that they were really a problem.
Yes.
And that's because we were looking primarily, not entirely, but primarily at the epidemiology to show that they were highly transmissible. And it took many weeks, if not over a month, for people to accept that the Delta variant was going to be a big problem based on how quickly it was overtaking the population in India. In contrast, the Omicron variant has created a lot of concern very quickly. And it even created concern amongst what would be regarded as very centrist scientific voices internationally. Now, I don't like using the term centrism in science, because centrism is a political concept, and science should be neutral from that.
Let's call them conservative voices.
Let's call very, very conservative voices have immediately been very concerned by the Omicron variant. And it's because when you look at the genetic structure, we can see that it has a large number of mutations that cluster around sites in the virus, which we know are likely to influence how transmissible it is, and we know are likely to influence how much it can evade the immune system. And more than that, some computational modeling studies have already been done and published in high impact scientific journals that predicted if we had mutations in these particular regions of the virus, that it would create a significant problem.
Let me see if I can put some fact and bone meat on the bone there. There are 50 mutations, I understand, in this new virus, and there are 30 on the spike protein.
Yes.
Are they figures you recognize? And tell us, for example, there are far fewer on the Delta.
Yeah, it's not just about the number of mutations, because lots of variants emerge and they all have mutations. Mutations, in a sense, they're almost more of a qualitative thing than a quantitative thing, because right. they change the structure of the virus and they change how it would function. And these mutations happen to lie in regions around the spike protein that would indicate that they will be better at getting into your cells and also better at evading your immune response.
Yes.
But the mutations and what they are structurally are categorical fact. They're no knowns and they're very worrying in themselves. Then we turn to the three questions of the effect of the mutation, as you outlined, the clinical, the epidemiological, and the immunological questions. And I think that it's really important to point out that when we see mutations in any organism, sometimes they don't really have the effects that we like. So if I start looking at the human population and I find a mutation in Eamon Dunphy's DNA, it may or may not be something to worry about, but I won't know it until I study the phenotype. And the phenotype is what we call the overall view of the organism. What does the mutation do for that organism? So for that, I need to study Eamon Dunphy's behavior and clinical profile. And that's what we need to be doing over the next few weeks. We'll be studying the phenotype of this mutation for the virus. And the first question is, does it make people sicker? Does it have greater clinical relevance? On that, I would say from my perspective, we know almost nothing. Now, I know that some people have reported that South African doctors have said this is milder, or it's mild in most yes. people. That's anecdotal. As far as I can see, it's meaningless, because COVID is mild in most people anyway. That's not why COVID is a problem. COVID is a problem because it gets everywhere, and it's not mild in a significant subset of the population. Other reports have said that actually more young people are going into hospital because of this variant. I don't think that's robust enough either. We don't know enough about what's happened in South Africa yet. And this virus may have been exposed to a lot of young people through universities down there, and there's other uncertainties. So on the clinical profile, I would say right now we're in the dark. But it doesn't need to have a significant change in the clinical profile for it to be a big problem for us. And even a small change in the clinical profile doesn't make a big difference. So the Delta variant is about twice as deadly as the original Wuhan variant, which sounds like a lot, but actually, because COVID has a relatively low case fatality rate, that doubling that with proper efforts doesn't result in a large increase in the death rate. The yeah. reason the death rate went up for Delta is because of transmissibility more than how deadly the virus is in itself. So then we go on to the question of transmission. What do we know about how this virus affects, how this variant affects transmission? And this is where things get worrying, because we have patchwork data from South Africa that suggests that this variant may well show increased transmissibility. This is what set off the alarm bells, as well as the mutational structure, which we could see as categorical no knowns. We had the data that showed it locally took over the COVID population in that region of South Africa, increased the positivity rate also, and now increased the hospitalization rate because of increased infection. So it's very worrying from a local epidemiological perspective, but we haven't seen how it spreads in other countries yet. The third thing is vaccine evasiveness. We don't know much about this yet. The way we'll learn about this is, first of all, lab studies are going to be done in the coming weeks to see how much these mutations actually affect antibody binding. And if it does affect antibody binding significantly, then it's likely to have an effect on a whole organism that would reduce the immune response. On top of that, we're going to be seeing how much the caseload in terms of people who are infected and people who are hospitalized with the Omicron variant, how many of them are vaccinated versus not vaccinated.
Yes.
That will also tell us about vaccine evasiveness. Now, it's also important to point out that the second two questions, transmissibility and immune evasiveness, those two are linked, because part of the reason why this may be spreading so quickly in South Africa may be because it is so good at evading the immune system. And a lot of people were infected with SARS-CoV-2. A lot of people have had COVID in South Africa, and they have a good amount of vaccination too. So if you assume that a large portion of the South African population have either previously been infected or previously vaccinated, then it could suggest that the transmissibility of this variant may be because partly it's so good at evading the immune system, as well as possibly being more transmissible, or some combination of those two properties. But we're currently in the dark about that. What we do know is anecdotally, but I think these are significant anecdotes. In countries that have looked very closely, such as Israel, there are cases where a cardiologist was in London, an Israeli cardiologist was in London for a conference. They contracted the Omicron variant after having three doses of Pfizer. And they then passed it on to another colleague who got infected and tested positive for the Omicron variant, even though they also had had three doses of Pfizer. So that is concerning.
That means the normal two doses plus a booster.
Exactly, because that's what they're doing in Israel.
Yeah, and what they're doing in the UK right now is increasing the booster jabs for everybody, including teenagers.
Yes.
Now, that's the British response, and it's just piling on in terms of the vaccine. Is that enough? Can the vaccine beat this Omicron variant, or can it contribute to a solution in the way you imagine Boris Johnson's head is working?
It's really a two-part question. The short answer is no. The vaccine cannot on its own deal with the Omicron variant. And the reason I know that is because the vaccine cannot on its own deal with the Delta variant.
Yes.
And we've learned this. It was theoretically known over the summer. It was empirically shown to be the case over the past few months in many countries. We can't deal with Delta with vaccination alone, and we can't deal with Delta with boosters alone. With Omicron, we've got the added issue of we don't know how much our vaccines are going to work against it. But even if it does work against it, it's not going to on its own be enough if Omicron is a problem, which it may or may not be. However, I think that boosters are the way to go. I don't even consider them boosters. I would be of the school of thought that says this is a three-course vaccine,
yep,
at least in the first instance, and maybe there will be boosters beyond that in the future. And yes, I would be prioritizing boosters for everyone. I would still prioritize vaccinating children first, but I think that every country should prioritize what we call boosters as one way of preemptively dealing with the threat of Omicron. But I don't think that's enough.
Right. Let me ask you about coronaviruses, plural. For example, MERS, that's a coronavirus, correct?
Yes.
SARS, that's a coronavirus, correct?
Yes, but we eradicated SARS-1.
Right. Why did MERS, which was around not too long ago, why was that conquered in a way that this COVID virus we're battling right now has not been?
Well, MERS has a very high case fatality rate. So if you get infected...
How come it never traveled?
I don't know enough about the history of the MERS of MERS infections, but I couldn't tell you off the top of my head what countries it was in and what it wasn't in. But the fact that it's so lethal means that it was dealt with a different type of priority and a different type of response. Same with SARS-1.
In East Asia, where it I think, originated.
And SARS-1 did arrive in Ireland. And it was only because of the quick thinking of the doctors who were dealing with it that that it was contained and that it was eliminated from Ireland. MERS is, I think it's got about a 30% case fatality rate. So it puts us in a completely different zone from SARS-CoV-2, which causes COVID-19.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Now, I don't want to get away from the point, but I just was interested in those two, MERS and SARS. The reason I'm asking that question is I want to get to something, and it's this. The possibility that COVID will become endemic and that every year we will need a shot, as we get a flu shot now. And, I mean, the flu virus changes from year to year, and the vaccine adjusts accordingly, correct?
The flu virus changes from year to year, and we re-engineer vaccines based on variants that are anticipated to be more troublesome. Endemic doesn't mean innocuous. Endemic just means it's in society. Like malaria is endemic in parts of Africa, and it's not something that you want to encounter. COVID-19 is liable with the current, with the Delta variant in Ireland. You know, it's liable to cause deaths that would be the equivalent of 5 or 7 or 10 flu seasons a year on top of the flu season. That's before we start talking about Omicron. So I don't think it's something that we can live with. You mentioned MERS. I think that it would be very disturbing if SARS-CoV-2 started to evolve in a direction where it had anything like the lethality of MERS. Yes. That could happen by random mutation if it kept evolving in that direction. It could happen by a very unfortunate recombination event, which is when two viruses essentially basically have sex and swap elements of their genomes. And you could end up with a hybrid virus. Hopefully that would never happen, but you can't rule that type of event out. When we're thinking about how Omicron affects the situation, I mean, I would divide the story into three possible outcomes. I mean, the good outcome is that this variant, Omicron, is not what we think it is. This is a false alarm, or maybe it has some of the properties we're worried about, but it's just less transmissible than Delta, and significantly enough so, such that it just can't compete with Delta. That's the good scenario. And then we're back to just worrying about Delta. Second scenario, which I think is far more likely, is that this is a game changer. And it's a game changer, at least in the way that the Delta variant was, or that the Alpha variant was. So that this takes us to the next level of difficulty in containing COVID-19, which makes vaccination more difficult, which makes herd immunity even less practical than it was.
Yes.
And which puts us in a very different situation for having to contain this pandemic. And I think that's the most likely scenario, but that spans a wide range of possibilities. And the third possibility is that it has very detrimental effects due to transmissibility or vaccine evasiveness. And that could put us in a very unpleasant situation, which I'd rather not, you know, hypothesize about the details of, because we just don't know enough yet. But the CEO of Moderna, one of the two companies that have made the fantastic RNA vaccines, has said quite clearly, speaking to the Financial Times today, that he believes that the vaccines will not work sufficiently well against Omicron. And that doesn't mean they won't work at all. So you will hear people in the media saying, oh, they will work, they won't work. It's not a binary thing. So everything with COVID, it's not a binary thing. Delta was a problem, partly because it reduced vaccine efficacy by about 90% for Pfizer initially to about 80%. And that clink in the armor has a huge effect on how the population is fortified by vaccination. So if you imagine Omicron brought down vaccine efficacy by a factor of 50%, that would be an enormous game changer. If you have some T cell response remaining and some antibody effect and some replenishment with boosters, a 50% reduction would completely transform what vaccines are doing for us.
Right.
And then if you imagine an 80 to 90% reduction, which is speculation, but you can imagine the kind of situation we're in. Small changes in vaccine efficacy and small changes in transmissibility on top of what the Delta variant already does makes a huge difference.
Right.
Whereas small changes in the clinical effect don't make a huge difference. You need a large change in the clinical effect to make a huge difference. So for example, MERS, the really worrying one we talked about, MERS is about 30 or 50 times as deadly as COVID-19. That's a large change. But with vaccine efficacy, you don't need it to be 30 times less effective. You only need it to be twice as less effective for it to have a huge difference for how we respond to it as a population. But Eamon, the same rules apply. Ventilation, mask wearing, testing and tracing, social distancing.
Social distancing, yes.
And we should really, I think, have a large degree of caution over this coming weeks. Now, as usual, I would say it's very instructive to look around the world, to look at what successful countries are doing and why. And when you look at the countries that are successful post-vaccination, the ones that are most successful post-vaccination are Israel and Japan. And the reason I call them post-vaccination successful is that they're open. They've got open domestic social lives and they're accepting travel into their countries. And they have excellent vaccine programs. They have very low case numbers. You know, they both have.
What did they do to achieve that we haven't done?
Well, we've talked about that in previous podcasts and that they have.
Just to remind us.
What Israel and Japan have done has focused on, in Israel on the vaccination front, they really went ahead with boosters. Japan had a very coordinated vaccination campaign that happened very quickly. So the population has a high degree of immunity because it hasn't started waning significantly there. But also a focus on ventilation, a focus on zoning in different areas, a focus on personal hygiene, which means masks and personal air hygiene, and just doing everything diligently. But most importantly, having the philosophy to reduce cases. So they're not going to eliminate the virus in Israel or Japan, but they have it aggressively suppressed with vaccination. Both of those countries, Israel and Japan, in the last few days have banned all travel into their countries.
Right.
You can't go into Japan. You can't go into Israel from anywhere. Now, this shows you how seriously they're taking the threat of Omicron, and they will be maintaining that level of caution for the next few weeks until we learn about what's happening. Now, it's my view that we should take a similar degree of seriousness with respect to the approach in Ireland. Now, immediately people say, well, we can't cross the border, we can't close the border with the UK, and you know, the usual conversation will emerge there. But the UK have seriously stepped up their measures. They're requiring a PCR test a day after anyone arrives in the UK from any country except the Republic of Ireland, and that you have to isolate for that day. Now, that is a huge change considering how liberal the UK's regime was for COVID just a week ago. But we're not mirroring that in Ireland, and we're not really doing anything at all. So in my view, the government needs to be doing everything it can to reduce travel into Ireland for the next 2 weeks. And furthermore, I think that we need to have the attitude of imagining ourselves. We need to imagine ourselves 1 week, 1 month, and 6 months from now. And we need to imagine our future selves in the different scenarios that could result from Omicron. And we need to have a framework of regret minimization. How much would we regret being very conservative for a week or two, just in case this variant is either a game changer or something nastier? And so I think that we need to press pause. I don't mean we should go into hard lockdown this week, even if Omicron is here in Ireland, which it may be. What I'm saying is that for the next week or two, we should really just press pause as much as possible on social activities, on interacting with people where we don't need to, get more diligent about mask wearing. You only wear FFP2 or KN95 face masks, which are just as comfortable as other masks, and certainly, you know, reinforce everything we should be doing in classrooms and in other high-risk environments. Because the more effort we put into now, and we've learned this before, the less we'll have to suffer in the future if this does go bad. And it is my concern that the government just don't seem to have learned from past mistakes.
Look, Tomás, we're no good at logistics. And a lot of the fight against this COVID virus is about logistics, whether it's testing and tracing, whether it's keeping people out of the country, whatever it is, really. Even it's showing your vaccine certificate to get into a club or a pub or a restaurant. We're just no good at it, and that's a problem. But I want to finally, for now, ask you this question. Surely the degree to which we're giving ourselves boosters, the Brits are boosting everybody who's moving, and not delivering the vaccine to poor countries, particularly in what we call the third world. The United States of America has given those countries more vaccines than the whole world combined. We need, don't we? We won't be safe until we commit to providing vaccines for the people living in those countries, and if we all, they need to promote the idea that the vaccines are good to take.
Absolutely. We need to, a pandemic is worldwide, and vaccination needs to be provided to all countries. But I think all countries also need to have a focus towards reducing the virus numbers. More variants will emerge in the future, and we can't ignore this, you know. So logistics is a limiting factor. Different countries need to, you know, tailor the response for their own country. We're not going to be as good at testing and tracing in Ireland as South Korea is. We can't control travel into the country the way China can. Parts of Australia have done extremely well because their public health has been excellent. I mean, right today, Queensland is zero COVID, Brisbane is zero COVID, and has been throughout much of the pandemic. So I think we should be learning from how those areas of Australia are doing their public health management, because we can apply that in Ireland in the medium term. But in the short term, I kind of agree with you that we have to work with our logistical capacities, which are not great at all. And I think that the government haven't been using that to inform their decisions. So we knew when we heard about Omicron being a problem on Thursday and Friday last week, we knew that our own testing and tracing capacity is completely saturated. And this is a problem for Ireland. So we knew that we wouldn't be detecting immediate effects in our environment. And we also knew that Ireland is one of the most connected European countries to South Africa.
Yes.
Although we knew those two things, we didn't do anything about it. And what I see here is a lack of pragmatism. You don't need to have an idealistic, you know, outcome when dealing with COVID. You need to be pragmatic and you need to work quickly because the most important asset that you have is time. And the more you squander time, yes, the more of a problem that you create for yourself. And on top of that, Eamon, I mean, I have to say there's been some misconceptions running around. This idea that the Omicron may be less dangerous than existing variants and may be a way of driving out COVID. Now, that's not impossible. It's just highly unlikely. Viruses do not evolve into less pathogenic forms. When we look at it historically and we say a virus has become less deadly with time, that is usually because it's killed all the vulnerable people.
Yes.
And the survivor population is less vulnerable to it. We don't want to do it that way, because that would be brutal. And that's what we've been resisting for a year and a half. But it looks like we may not even have the option for doing it that way with COVID-19 because of reinfection. And because you do replenish the vulnerable population all the time with people aging, but with also people getting pre-existing conditions, which a large portion of the population have. And indeed, even though I'm a relatively healthy person in middle life, I don't want to get infected with COVID every season because I'll be rolling a dice every time. Yes. And so it looks like the way this virus reinfects people means that we wouldn't even be able to move towards a less pathogenic form by sacrificing, you know, 50,000 people or whatever it would end up being. But there is the possibility that, you know, a less pathogenic variant might emerge, but that's highly unlikely.
Right. Okay, Tomás. We're very grateful to you for joining us and for that review of where we are. I'd just like to make it clear to everybody who's listening to this podcast, and I'm sure Tomás would agree with me, that to talk about this crisis and this virus in this way is to inform our listeners to the Stand. It is not to ignore the grievous pain of people in business, people who are losing their jobs, and most importantly of all, people working on the front line who for 20 months or more now have been fighting this dreadful disease. We're very, very conscious of it. I know Tomás is, but it's important that we know in clinical terms, in public health terms, what we're dealing with, which is why we do the podcast with Tomás the way we do. And over the 20-month period, he has been right about almost everything, most recently about schools and children and school children and indeed teenagers. So we're grateful to Tomás Ryan, to all of you for listening. That's all we have time for now. We'll talk to you soon.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.